Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes with two very interesting guests. You're both professors at Princeton, Julian Zelizer and Kevin Cruz, whose book, Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, just came out. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Appreciate it. I personally just think the most fascinating question is, how the hell did we get here? Where did this come from? How long has this been festering or brewing out here? Now, last week I talked with Steve Kornacki, whose book traces the rise of political tribalism to the 1990s. You start with the 1970s. So talk a little bit about where you might differ in emphasis and why you think the dividing line, the turning point, was the 70s.
Well, Steve's book is terrific and very, very useful. For us, though, the 70s was a natural starting point because of various crises the country goes through that we think really move us from one era to another. We talk a lot about the economic crisis of the 1970s with stagflation that really shocks the economy and gets us out of that post-World War II era, and I think sets up the conditions for the new partisanship. The crisis over the legitimacy of government and government institutions, which fuels both the left and right, really comes out of that decade. And we start with Nixon resigning as a key moment, but also a symbolically important moment when all the tensions over Vietnam, over the presidency, come together. And we think that's a defining part of the decade as well. And finally, the different social movements that will shape the next few decades, including the conservative movement, which is really a driving force in this era, takes shape in the 70s. That's when it starts to come together and brings Reagan into office in 1980. So for us, that's important in terms of thinking of the chronology.
So was there one turning point? Is there one moment that you focus on, say, okay, you know, things were different after this point?
There are a lot of these moments. I mean, the 74 is the flashpoint for us, largely because of Richard Nixon's resignation after Watergate, which is a huge shock to the political system. But right around there, you've got a couple other major moments. You've got the 1973 oil embargo from OPEC, which really does shock the American economy in a way in which it hadn't been shocked before. Roe v. Wade in 1973 is a huge new fault line that emerges on lines of gender and family values. 1975, the withdrawal of American troops from Vietnam really is a humbling moment for American foreign policy. So there's a series of events that kind of in staccato fashion happened in that 73, 74, 75 moment.
And you really did feel that things were falling apart. You talk about a crisis of legitimacy. As bad as things are right now, it is useful to go back and realize, you know, after the late 60s, after 68, all of these things happening, it really did feel like we were tearing apart.
Yeah, we have a story in the oil crisis. There's a big executive from when they have lines to get gas, and there's a big executive from one of the oil companies, and he's in the back of the line, and someone recognizes him, and the gas attendant says, "Do you want to just come to the front to get your gas?" And he's like, "No," you know. He says, "I don't think that's going to be a good idea because of how angry people are." And I think that story and some of the films of the era really capture not just the anger, but the sense of almost hopelessness and uncertainty about the future. There was a sense the kind of great era of this country was over, and it was unclear if we were going to recover if you're standing in the middle of the 1970s.
Well, I want to talk about the theme of the book, which you repeat throughout the book, is the fault lines. So what are the fault lines?
Well, we mean that in two senses. So first of all, there are these four big lines that we start to trace in the first four chapters of the book, and they are lines of politics, of political polarization, economics. It's really a story about growing economic inequality, racial divisions, and then a fault line of issues around gender and sexuality and family values. And so that's one set of fault lines. But mapped over that increasingly is a story of the media. And so by this we mean fault lines in another sense of the lines about who's at fault for all these problems we have.
So these fault lines had been around for a long time. They didn't just appear. What held them in check? What changed that these fault lines resulted in what we call the tribalism, the divisiveness of American politics?
Well, if you think of the period between the 1920s or 1930s and the early 70s, roughly as a period, the tensions are there. There's obviously tremendous tensions over issues like race and foreign policy. But there's other forces that have the other effect. And Some of those include the role the federal government played during that era, both in the New Deal and World War II and in the period that came after. The role of unions was often a thread for different social groups by the 1950s and 60s, and an institution that existed, you know, across many lines. Even in the media, you did have during that period an era of a handful of networks were where we looked for our information, a handful of city papers, and it wasn't a totally fragmented world.
Right. And so we had a shared experience.
Right, and those institutions didn't mean there weren't divisions, but there was this other part of the country which we think was really important. And those are exactly the institutions that come under challenge by the 70s, and we think they're not replaced by comparable institutions in politics and media elsewhere. It's a much more fragmented, disjointed, and divisive world that's recreated after.
Okay, so your case is that the what we're seeing right now has its roots in the 70s. But when I first saw the theory, one of my first reactions was, and yet we, you know, it was followed by the 1980s, which was a much more confident, much more optimistic, much more prosperous time. The 1990s, which now looks very quaint in retrospect, although clearly the political divisions were increasing. So, what is the trend line from 1974 to the moment we're at right now? It's obviously not a straight line, is it?
No, there's zigs and zags. We're historians, so. We're not political scientists who say, here's the cause. Once this happens, you can basically get us to where we are today. There's different moments. So as the economy swings, for example, in the middle of the 1980s, generally the economy is doing very well. It does have some kind of positive effect, obviously. There's different political eras. But you can, if you look back and you look at all the decades, you see some of these tensions gradually building in the way that things work. So if you do the history of the media, sure, not every moment is as bad as where we are today, you could argue. It's not quite as crass and divisive. But the changes that create the modern media, the advent of cable television, the growth of a social media landscape where everyone can say whatever they want, the 24-hour news, these are building over time. And our job as historians is to try to give you that big picture.
So, yeah, I want to come back to the media because you had a piece in the Washington Post about the fairness doctrine and the before and after of the fairness doctrine. But I thought it was interesting that I read that you had finished this book before Donald Trump was elected president. So you saw this, you saw the moment we're in right now coming, but probably like the rest of us didn't know it would be quite this
right.
So awful.
Right.
So.
Yeah, again, we started running this in 2012, you know, before Obama was reelected, much less before, Trump was even on the horizon as a political candidate, really. And so his election in a lot of ways seemed to put a bow on some of the things that we've been talking about, the growing political polarization, the alarm bells over economic inequality and economic insecurity that I think he spoke to in a lot of ways. Certainly the fragmented media, which he clearly took advantage of, both in terms of his relationship with folks on Fox News, but also he really took advantage of social media in a way in which no politician really had before. So a lot of the things that we'd already been talking about came to a head in Trump. But I think that was more of a reflection of the fact that we don't see the story ending with Trump. Trump is rather coming out of these long-term trends, and they're going to continue after Trump. They may take on slightly new forms, as we've seen before. But this isn't a story that certainly ends with Trump.
Okay.
It's going to carry on.
So on this new media landscape, I'm fascinated to get your answer to this question. If we had the current media ecosystem, would Richard Nixon have survived Watergate?
Yeah, I've thought about that question. I've talked about it a lot. And I think there's a case to be made that it could have helped because you have to remember Nixon's resignation is not automatic. And it takes a long time for many Republicans to break with the president. And it's unclear whether Democrats are going to end up going through with the impeachment
And he didn't have
process.
These megaphones defending him and attacking his critics.
So he didn't have that. Right. And you could imagine a guy who wins a landslide victory in 72, which is being talked about like another 1936 reelection, maybe a potential realignment. He was Reagan before Reagan came about, that if you also added to that a massive world of media that would support him, that would attack everyone, you know, from Elliot Richardson to the different members of Congress who lead the investigation, that it could have helped him in the end. I think it was something that was missing from that era, which makes today very, very different.
And in a lot of ways, the people who created our current media climate learned those lessons. You know, Roger Ailes was a media advisor to Richard Nixon, and he had a formidable task at the time. He said, you know, people look at Nixon like a somebody who was 41 years old the day he was born. Other kids got a football for Christmas. Young Richard Nixon got a briefcase and loved it. But he does a great job of repackaging Nixon. It's ultimately he does a phenomenal job in terms of the 72 election and really making that happen. But after Watergate, he realizes that actually there's a lot more to do here. And so in the 70s, Ailes is somebody who's interested in maybe forming a fourth broadcast network. He doesn't quite get it at the time. He keeps working with Republican politicians. He's in there with the George H.W. Bush campaigns in 88 and 92. But before he's even out the door with Bush, he's in the door with Rush Limbaugh. He's helping to produce Limbaugh's a television program from 92 to 96, right when he starts up Fox News. So a lot of those lessons from the Nixon era of wow, wouldn't this be different if Nixon had his own kind of media in his corner, the way in which we feel liberals have the mainstream media in their corner, that really does come into fruition two decades later.
I feel like this is like the Saturday Night Live routine where it was like, what if Spartacus had had a Piper Cub? You know? if Spartacus had had an F-15, if Nixon would have had a Rush Limbaugh.
Right.
Because you look back on all the things that were tearing us apart in the 1970s and what an impeachment of Donald Trump would do to the country. And at least in retrospect, the country was not torn apart by the Nixon impeachment. There were so many other things, and we got over it very, very quickly. People are not waving the bloody flag about Richard Nixon in the way they would for 20 years after the hypothetical removal of a Donald Trump. So let's go back into the 70s, though. There was no talk radio. There was no Fox News. There was no social media. None of those things happened.
Yeah.
In fact, the conservative media was pretty small and mediocre. And I think a lot of people forget that when Ronald Reagan was elected president, for most of his presidency, he didn't have a robust conservative media. He didn't have conservative talk radio. And I wonder whether that's an underrated factor in how Reagan was able to govern. You know, he was able to do things that I'm not sure any Republican would ever be able to do anymore.
I think that's a good point. At one of the looking back at Reagan, there's many important parts of his presidency, such as his role in bringing this conservative movement into power, but certainly his ability to understand how to communicate and how to work with the media that he had was really pretty formidable. And I think an important part of his success in different ways, certainly in the kind of making sure after his first election in 1980 that the public saw this as a revolution rather than just another election, to the way in which he maneuvered with Gorbachev when he had a lot of opponents in the conservative movement to what he was doing, to sell what he was doing
and
to
immigration.
The public. And he didn't have a
– right.
I mean, he had the National Review. You had magazines, but it wasn't like this. So he had more pressure in many ways, I think, than a current – than President Trump would have.
I mean, right now, President Trump is, in effect, held hostage by the conservative media.
Right.
You know, if Rush Limbaugh breaks bad on him on the wall or Ann Coulter – Ronald Reagan was able to embrace amnesty, was able to make a deal with Gorbachev without that kind of, you know, pressure.
In a lot of ways, that's because Reagan was himself an expert at media, right? I mean, he comes out of a career as an actor. He had been a very, you know, popular TV host in the 1950s with the GE Hour. He works in radio in the 1970s. There weren't a lot of conservatives on radio, but Ronald Reagan was one of them. And you can look back over those scripts in which he goes over by, you know, line after line and is crafting the message, this word here. And it's a really a fine-tooth comb he pours over these speeches with. So he's somebody who understood the message. And when he goes into office, it's not just that he is the great communicator who can make these speeches and really speak optimistically to the American people in a way in which Jimmy Carter never could. Carter could never master that kind of optimism. Reagan projects this sunny attitude about America being back, the famous Morning in America Again campaign of 84. But he's got a team around him that really does a phenomenal job of crafting that message. So Mike Deaver and David Gergen have message discipline in the White House. Again, a marked change from kind of the chaos of the Carter administration, where they've got a message of the day and they make sure they've got a photo op on this. They make sure this line gets repeated. And it really just hammer home this message with incredible effectiveness.
And another important point is, so we're historians, so things evolve over time, mm-hmm. including in this period. And the 80s is still a transitional moment with polarization. I mean, with the media is a great example where it hasn't really totally taken form. Fox News right. won't go on the air till 96. But even with the parties are still more divided than they would be today internally. Southern Democrats still
more diverse,
have weight yeah. in right. the Democratic Party. And so he can imagine picking these off. And similarly, the Republican Party hasn't totally shifted to the right at that point. And so that electoral landscape, it's moving. It's not what it was in the 60s, but it's not where it is in 2018, I think gave him different kinds of political challenges that didn't totally lock him in right. to a predictable partisan roadmap.
Let me give you a theory that you might reject. Feel free to reject and push back on. That in the 1970s, particularly after Nixon, you had this rise of the new right, which in many ways had a Trumpian feeling. It was a push against the elites. It was nationalist. You had hyper-nationalist. You also had a flirtation on the right with people like George Wallace, because mm-hmm. he was our son of a bitch and he was going to fight hard.
Right.
But because of the rise of Reagan, those folks were somewhat pushed off to the side, at least for a time. And so when we talk about some of the things that are going on with Donald Trump, the hyper-nationalism, I would say the white identity politics, some of those aspects, I've described those as not necessarily the inevitable outgrowth of the conservative movement, but always a recessive gene. Mm-hmm. And that the recessive gene was kept recessive throughout most of the 80s and throughout most of the 90s. And then emerged to the shock of the Republican Party later. So whether you see more of a straight line that the Trump represents things that were always in the conservative movement, or whether in fact there was a very robust counterweight, there were actually guardrails, there were actually gatekeepers who now no longer exist.
There's definitely a shift in the party on these issues, and you can only look at one you've already mentioned, which is immigration. The 1980 Republican primaries, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush are vying for who can be more friendly to undocumented immigrants, who's going to do more for these and welcome them into America. And there's a real confidence that Reagan has.
It's sort of shocking to watch those videos.
It's shocking
now.
To watch it, right? And there's a real confidence that Reagan has. He makes it one of his opening speeches is a town I used to live in, Jersey City, New Jersey. He's on Liberty State Park with the Statue of Liberty behind him. And this is his message. We're a country of immigrants and we all come here and we all get made of it. It's a confidence in the American experiment that it's going to remake people. And so in 86, you've got the move for immigration reform, which includes amnesty, which would have been a toxic issue today. Fast forward to George W. Bush in the early 2000s, who tries to have some immigration reform, who sincerely, I think, wants to broaden the party. He's got African-Americans and Latinos in high positions in his cabinet. You think of Colin Powell and Condi Rice, Alberto Gonzalez. He really does, I think, have a sincere desire to outreach and bring Latinos into the party. He sees an opening here. They're going to be a natural constituency. Wants to push on this issue. There he runs up, though, against this new talk media, this new conservative media, which really does push back against this issue and destroys it. Fast forward again to today, and now that kind of conservative talk media is in charge, really, of the party's policy agenda, and the situation is entirely flipped.
But it's there, and I think it's important now to look back at the history of conservatism and to see the gatekeepers, to see the continued efforts at coalitional politics, but to see this other element was there from the start.
I know.
Nixon played with it during his campaigns. There's elements of it in the 1976 Reagan's primary challenge. He's trying to bring in these other voices. Mm-hmm. Newt Gingrich, you can clearly argue, introduces a style of partisanship, which leads us into today, to the Tea Party. There's parts that were there and might have been more formidable than some conservatives wanted to acknowledge, or easier to contain. And certainly talk radio is a great example. That's in the late 80s and 90s. It's not in the 2000s that that's taking form. You listen to Bob Grant, a famous conservative talk radio. You can hear the rhetoric we hear today.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think we're trying to do both. I mean, we want to capture the broad history, but we want to kind of look back and say this was there all along.
Well, this is the kind of thing that, you know, as a conservative that I look back and realize, okay, you know, what did I not see or took for granted, you know, that I took for granted that the Republican Party was trending in the ways you just described, you know, more aspirational, the Jack Kemps of the world, as opposed to when, in fact, they were maybe a thinner crust over the Republican base than we had suspected. And then, of course, talk radio, you know, stoked this. You mentioned Bob Grant.
Yeah.
I was actually on his show, I think it must have been 1992, actually in studio like this. And during the break, there was a commercial break, and then he starts talking, and I was shocked at just the raw racial rhetoric coming from this guy. I remember going home and going, this is just unbelievable. This is a big talk radio guy in New York City, and he's a complete – this is not a gray line bigot thing, when, of course, this became very obvious later. And so you do wonder, you know, what fires had been laid there. I do also wonder whether or not – because somebody asked me about this yesterday is who's in charge now in – Is it Donald Trump or is it Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh or is it something else? And I'm toying with the idea that Rush Limbaugh has also trapped himself, that the last thing on earth you want to do, that after years of the talk radio host leading public opinion, now they have created this base that will hold them accountable, and that Rush Limbaugh is as trapped as Donald Trump, because if he endorses this deal and other more populist nationalists get to his right, he's in trouble. So, to a certain extent, they lit the fire in the dumpster, and now they no longer are able to control it.
I think that's fair. It's partisanship, and a particular kind of partisanship is in control more than a person.
Right.
And so politicians are constantly looking to, you know, how do I secure my job and how do I win? And that's often where they end up right now, play to what we call the base, but in fact, it's broader than that within the GOP right now. And that partisanship is powerful. And it's hard to get out of even if you want to.
Right.
And you see this with some of the critics of President Trump within the GOP. They speak a little bit on the floor, but then they kind of step back a little bit when it comes down to a vote.
But even, I mean, look at someone like Eric Cantor, right, who really was one of the people really kind of pushing the Republican Party to really be as firmly oppositional to President Obama as humanly possible, and really pushed his caucus to an extreme. And then he loses a primary to Dave Brandt, right? There's nothing that's going to be enough to do that. If Eric Cantor gets run out to the right, who's going to survive?
Yeah, well, we're, you know, old enough to remember when Paul Ryan was the was the insurrectionist, right? Mm-hmm, so right. What is your take on how will history remember Paul Ryan's speakership?
I think for me, I think he will be a transitional Republican. I mean, I think there's a series of Republicans who come from the world you're describing and have written about, but are gradually forming alliances with this other element of the conservative staff base that's gaining more power. I think Boehner was very aware of what the Tea Party was, but he made a calculation as Speaker. Those are good votes. That's a pretty cohesive block of votes, and it's going to be very effective. And he thought, I can contain them. There are guards. If I need to kind of step back, I can.
Yeah.
That's false logic.
Yeah.
And we see this with all the speakers since him. We even write about George H.W. Bush in the 88 campaign, where he brings Lee Atwater, and Lee Atwater puts together a campaign that certainly is not Bush-like in terms of civility. And there's an idea, though, after the campaign, I'll step back. Those forces are gone. They don't go away.
Right.
And I think Speaker Boehner is a perfect figure to look at that dynamic.
Yeah, I always think of the analogy of, you know, you nurture the alligator in the bathtub, and then you walk in someday and it's loose and it's eating people, and then you just try to figure out how you are the last person eaten,
right?
By the one that you have done. You know, I mentioned before we actually started this, though, that I wanted to give you a chance to respond to some of the critics of this book. That this is from the Wall Street Journal. That basically says that you've packed the story with villains and victims, and the villains are almost always the same, Republicans and conservatives. And let's see here, that you portray one dispute after another as if it were largely or wholly the result of the stupidity, bigotry, or arrogance of Republican office holders and their allies.
Well, I think
I always like to have a chance to answer my critics. So
this is great. I'll start up. Yeah. I think that reviewer might have seen the element of the book that spoke to that thesis. There are certainly lots of liberals and Democrats who we call out for their own stupidity. I don't think Carter comes off especially well in the book. We fault Clinton for impeachment. One of the big things, especially of a concern to folks on the left, is the rise of mass incarceration in the carceral state. Mm-hmm. We lay that squarely at the feet of some of the Democrats in 1994 who really do embrace this policy for their own survival. So I think there are a lot of things in there that might put that argument needs to be qualified a little bit.
Yeah, listen, besides the fact that a lot of the specific things he said are flat out wrong and manipulating what we said, I think two things. One, we don't write a history blaming one side or another, or blaming people. We're writing a history of a period. And so I think he saw in this story what his image is of professors and how they see the past. Okay. We just wanted to understand what were the crises that happened, how did they unfold, what were key moments. That said, one of the big stories of the period is the evolution of the Republican Party, not just the rise of the conservative movement, but at least in the last 20 years, this new radicalization of the party that we've been talking about. And to kind of say, well, then you have to write the history where it's simply they did this, they did that, this equivalency. It's actually not good to the Republican Party. It's not good to the history. If something's more pronounced in part of American society, you write about it and you capture it.
So who were the primary aggressors in the culture war? Because the story that cultural conservatives told themselves was that they didn't want to get involved in politics, that they were reluctant ideological warriors, but they were simply responding to the attack and they were defending their values and their traditions. So who really were the aggressors in this culture war?
Well, again, I think it would depend on where you look. Yeah. And you can argue this is a response. Both sides would say this – here, I'm both sides in it. Both sides would say that it's – that they're being responsive to what the other side had done. So the narrative of the religious right, when it comes out crystal clear in 1980 at the Religious Roundtable in Dallas, Texas, where James Robinson gets up and says, I'm sick of all the gays and – I'm paraphrasing. We're sick of all the gays and lesbians and liberals coming out of the closet. It's time for God's people to come out of the closet. The argument Falwell makes right. is that if evangelical and fundamentalist, if conservative evangelical and fundamentalists don't get out there and vote, then the godless are going to be the only ones who vote, right? So we have a duty to do this, and it's a sense of kind of stepping up. At the same time, then those on the left would argue that then that influx of conservative Christians who shaped policy was something that they had to respond to. So one of the stories, another story we talk about in the book, is the rise of gay and lesbian activism and the way in which AIDS is initially literally laughed off by Reagan spokesman Larry Speaks. They joke about it in the White House, and it's if you look back, it's kind of an amazing episode. But gays and lesbians who feel like neither Republicans or Democrats are really speaking to them come forward with groups like ACT UP and really put AIDS on the national agenda. And so then fast forward into the George W. Bush administration, and one of the things he does in a 2003 State of the Union address is propose a massive amount of funding to fight AIDS on a global scale. It's really a remarkable and incredibly successful thing he does. And so it shows you the way in which yes, some of this is responsive left or right, but sometimes those responses are good, and it's good to react to these things. And so it's less about placing blame of who started it and rather chronicling what happens as this culture war unfolds.
Yeah, and the conservative movement for us is actually a very important part of our story, and it's a legitimate, it's a coherent, it's a pretty powerful movement that we're arguing actually reshapes politics. It represents large parts of the population. We don't like dismiss the members. It's in fact the opposite. If you really kind of go back to the story of the book, it's all these things fall apart. And this is really a first mover in reshaping the debate. Good or bad depends on your perspective on it. But we're focused on collectively what did this movement do to politics.
Well, I'm not going to push back too hard on you since I wrote a book, How the Right Lost Its Mind here. So you mentioned Jerry Falwell. Yeah. And I find this endlessly fascinating. You have Jerry Falwell Sr., who is the pivotal figure in the moral majority. You've just described him. And now Jerry Falwell Jr. is the perhaps the number one, or at least in the top 10, evangelical defenders, enablers, rationalizers of Donald Trump. How did the evangelical Christian movement go from all about those values and character counts to where they are right now?
A lot of it happened as they went from being an oppositional force to being kind of captured by movement conservatism, right? I mean, and so – and become part of these White Houses.
So the transactionalism, being close to power?
I think a little bit of that, yeah. There are compromises they make. And at first, they're fine. It's not really a compromise. It's coalitional politics. So Falwell cares passionately in the late 70s. About what he sees as the onslaught of feminism and the rise of gay rights. He starts to care late in the decade about abortion. It becomes a major issue. But then he also starts talking about national defense and the Panama Canal, things that hadn't really been a concern for evangelicals, but they're part of this larger coalition. So he's going to talk about them. Once they've though become a part of the Republican Party, really, they start to resent that their policy isn't getting pushed. The Reagan administration largely turns just lip service over to social conservatism. Then with the Christian Coalition and Pat Robertson's run in 1988, and then really the capture of a lot of local party structures in the early 90s, they really become a force in the Republican Party. And then under George W. Bush, they really are they have a seat at the table, and they're really mm-hmm. shaping things. And you think about the laws against partial birth abortion in 2003, or the movement for a federal marriage amendment in 2004 as a real campaign issue. They feel they're finally being heard. It starts to break apart soon after that, though. First with Terry Schiavo, where the country increasingly feels like this voice of religious conservatism has gotten too pronounced in the party, and so you have people like Chris Shays saying, "I don't recognize our party anymore." You know, but then in the present day, what's happened is they become so wedded, and you're speaking mm-hmm. of Jerry Falwell Jr., so wedded to that access to power, so concerned with just a few issues, and it's really the Supreme Court nominees that really brought them in line in the summer of 2016. They kind of came on board at that meeting at Trump Tower. We had 1,000 of those leaders there, and they walk out and they're like, "All right, he promised us pro-life judges, that's all we need, and we're going to go to bat." And now they're locked in with him. And the excesses that get exposed about his personal life and his activities, as they give excuses to that, they're really paying a price. And so if you look at the base of evangelical and fundamentalists, even at Liberty University, students there are really starting to chafe against what Jerry Falwell Jr. is doing. And so you're starting to see a real generational shift among evangelicals and fundamentalists there, but I think is going to really spell the end of this old leadership.
Well, this generational shift is going to be a real problem for the conservative movement. There's just a Pew study out today, which I'm sure you guys saw, showing that Generation Z is even more progressive than the millennials. I lose track of all the generations here. That clearly, even though they may be winning political fights at the moment, they're losing this cultural battle. So this, by the way, is the hardest question, I think, to ask. Is like, so how do you see this playing out? How do we get out of this? You know, is there going to be a reaction? Is history sort of a pendulum, or is it a vortex? because you commented on this, all of the talk about let's talk across the divide and all of that stuff, which was a lot of cant.
I mean, I don't think we see it as a pendulum, and I don't think we see it as inevitable that we will get out of this, meaning these things accrue over time. The kind of politics and social interaction we're talking about are built now into the way our institutions work, from gerrymandering to the media issues we've talked about. So it's not that easy to get out of. Two lessons from the history is, one, paying attention to reforming how our institutions work. This was a big effort in the 70s after Watergate. That's important. How do you change the rules of the game? How do you change
and that matters.
That matters. Right. How campaign finance is done. How are primaries organized? What choices do media outlets make in terms of what kind of programming? Those can have an effect because they will outlast a president. And the 70s, our book is arguing that you go through a period of big change that leads us into the current era. So you can go through that. But I think it's going to be more bottom up. I think it's going to have to really be pushed by voters and movements who ultimately don't find this a satisfying status quo.
You know, I quoted it's probably an apocryphal quote from Mark Twain, that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And as I think about the roots of this in the 1970s, I wonder 30, 40, 50 years from now, what are the consequences of our time going to be? Because, you know, what are we laying the kindling for right now? You know, what is going to be the rhyme going forward? Because as you point out, Donald Trump's going to leave office someday. And yeah. And yet none of this goes away. I mean, right. this is all a pre-existing condition, and it will survive. But, so that's why, you know,
I mean, the question is: Does it become a stimulus for right. the kinds of changes? And Nixon actually was.
It was.
It's funny, people ask us, why do you start in 1974? Mm-hmm. And there's many reasons, but I always, well, the president did. He resigned in the middle of a term. Like, we should know that was a big shock to the system. And maybe you're right. I mean, maybe in the end, not regardless of how his presidency ends, the shock and the awe of President Trump and everything that has happened in itself won't change this world. But maybe that's what we're seeing. It stimulates new generational voices, new classes to Congress, and new elements throughout society that start to do the hard work, decade-long work.
And you are seeing some evidence of this. Yeah. I mean, you are seeing people rethinking some of the dogmas and all of those things. And the consequences of it. You know, for example, I think a lot of people find, you know, the whole issue of gerrymandering to be a very wonky thing. But back in the 1970s, as recently as that, we actually did have diversity in the parties. You actually did have conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. Mm-hmm. And as part of the consequence of gerrymandering is that you don't have that anymore. It does not exist. So what story are you most obsessed about today?
Today?
Yeah, just today.
From the book or?
No. This is part of the problem of living through this time. Oh. This is going to be a challenge for historians, yeah. and not being an historian myself, is how do you capture the pace of 2017, 2018, 2019? What it was like to live through these days with the shocks. I'm just obsessed with we talked about Liberty University before, the sort of story of Michael Cohen mm-hmm. giving a bag, you know, Walmart bag full of cash to the guy who's the IT head for Liberty University to pay for the rigging of Drudge, you know, online right. polls. It's yeah. like, as somebody tweeted out, another reminder, we're not actually dealing with the varsity here.
Right,
but
right.
still.
Yeah, as I tweeted out, it was like, you know, it's like breaking into a bank to steal a stash of Monopoly money. Like I mean, it's an online poll. I mean, you know, and I understand there's a certain allure to winning any kind of poll that I guess was worth $50,000 and a boxing glove. But it seems like money I'm not sure was well spent. But it does. I think that story captures a lot. Liberty University and the IT guy yeah. is the connection between those two. The role of Michael Cohen as the fixer. The fact that it's a Drudge Report poll that they're going after. I mean, a lot of the themes that we talk about in the book pop up in yeah. that story. So yeah, that's a great one.
For me, I'd say it's a little more boring. It's Senator McConnell. I'm fascinated with him. And through him, how partisanship is holding so firmly, even with everything that we are talking about. And we are now doing this in the middle of the longest government shutdown, which he is not moving desperately to try to change. And I think he's really an important element of where he's quiet. He's not, at least in public, like President Trump, but he's a power broker. And I think he explains a lot of why many things we see are tolerable, tolerated, and happening. And following him for me is a great barometer of what's going on in the GOP.
It's almost like he's sulking at the moment, you know, having set this up and then, you know, being cut off at the knees by the president.
Right.
Because you know that there's no negotiations if he's not participating in them. But also the position he's taking, which is that I'm not going to take a vote if the president's going to veto it. It's like there was once a time when the leader of the Senate would have had just sort of some institutional jealousy. Some, you know, like, no, I'm not giving you
exactly
complete
right.
veto power over everything we do. Well, this is a story to be continued. Julian Zelizer, Kevin Cruz, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.